everybody to the September D meeting. Starting out, I want to actually start by introducing our newest board member, Don Russo.
Hi.
Ask that you give us a little background so we know where you're at and where you're coming from and all that.
You bet. I very briefly grew up in Chicago, been out here since 1977. I've been practicing law since 1977 here in Vancouver. This will be my 41st year this fall, 41 years, where the hell the time went. I do 95% of what I do is commercial and industrial real estate, buying and selling, not my own buying and selling, but for clients, buying and selling, financing, and leasing. Private parties, public parties. I can mention that we are counsel for the Port of Vancouver, so I'm very familiar with what's going on the waterfront and involved in that. I'm excited to be here. There you go. And I'm on the chamber. I've been with the chamber. I was on the board for 9 years and now co-chair of the Public Affairs Committee. And this is a good connection for the board, for the chamber board to know what's going on as well. Hi, Eric.
Okay. Chicago.
What's the time?
It's from Chicago.
Chicago kid. Yeah. From the South, S-O-U-T side.
Okay. Yeah. Welcome aboard.
Do you ever deal with Tim Back?
I'm sure you have. I know Tim. Yeah, very well.
So we got to be careful what we call Chicago.
That's right. He's not reflective of the entire city. I love him to death. But.
I'm causing all kinds of trouble.
We'll dive right into the rest of the introductions. I'm Steve Bacon, Clark Regional Wastewater District.
Greg Schaefer, Clark County Development Engineering.
Sheree Burmaster, Public Works.
Jeff Riston, Kingston Homes.
Eric Olima, SGA Engineering.
Mike Overham, Olson Engineering.
Laura Zabowski, Clark County Community Planning.
Jersey, Clark County Parks.
Martin Anderson, Parks Advisory Board.
Ryan McKinster, BIA of Clark County.
Ryan. Stephen Addison, Auto Construction.
Houston, Auto Construction.
Is that
all
this name, Blaine?
Jeff
A. Bruce
Cook, Deputy
Prosecutor. Reminder, the meeting is recorded and will be posted on Deed's website. You've got a cell phone. Get it on silent or vibrate or something that makes it less obnoxious. Just in time, too.
Well, one of the problems on the minutes is going to be, Jared, I missed the last meeting.
That's okay.
Don, is all right? We can still?
I have to abstain, too. In those instances, the majority of what you have available to that were there.
Perfect.
We have a quorum. Extensions don't count against the majority.
Okay, perfect.
So, with that, folks, we were here.
Move to approve.
Motion to approve minutes?
Second.
All right. Motion in a second.
A lot of us weren't here. There's.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstention?
Abstain.
Yes.
Yes.
Jeff and I are abstaining. All right. So it should be reflected in.
Review of upcoming events.
Page two, back page of your agenda there. Quickly, Clark County Council. Typical work sessions are every Wednesday, and hearings every Tuesday. Of note, the first Tuesday of the month is typically an evening meeting starting at 6 o'clock. specific sessions, Clark County Communities Bicycle and Pedestrian 2018 Work Program, September the 12th, 9:30 a.m. Work session on a countywide open data policy implementation, September 12th, 11 a.m. 2018 final supplemental, that's on September the 19th, 9:30 a.m.
Final supplemental what?
Must be a supplemental.
Oh, budget. Okay, thanks.
Budget. Thank you for that clarification. And then finally, the freight rail, September 26th, 10:30 a.m. Planning Commission work sessions and hearings, urban holding removal, staff report, notice of DNS map, public comments received to date, PowerPoint presentation, September 6th, 6:30. That's this evening, 6:30 p.m.
Which area is that?
Right now.
Going forward, and the state statute and county code are silent on the usage of impact fees for trails, so that's why we're basically, if you want to include this into county code. So county has maintained programmatic application of impact fees for urban parks and open space. So in Title 40, it narrowly defines PIF, which is narrower than may be allowed. It doesn't really specifically state trails in there. It says parks, recreation, and open spaces, but we need to be clearly defined what recreation includes, and we want to include trails as a part of that. So discussion for usage of impact fees to support trails goes back to the late 1990s, and as I stated earlier, we're going to actually try to accomplish that this year. So.
Why is it?
What's that?
What, it's gone back to 1990s discussion? Yeah, discussion. What have been passed? Objections or hindrances?
I don't think it's never been really acted on.
Okay, that's what. Okay.
Really clearly defined it, and so we needed to change code to do that.
Okay.
So we want to take that step and make that happen.
Thank you.
So Title 40, 620.20, which I actually passed out to you, so you can actually see the county code, and it shows the PIF calculation. Last time I was here last month, I think you were asking for the PIF calculation itself, and so right here on county code, it does show that PIF calculation. And its definitions as to what all these symbols mean. So,
quick question on that equation on the sheet.
Yes.
So I see the T's added in, and maybe I've
got that right. Yes.
Does that mean that the PIF goes up because there's a new factor in there, or does another one go down to compensate for the PIF going up, or the T being added?
It actually, I'll get to that in a little bit. But yes, it actually does provide an increase.
And it's we'll an increase in the PIF?
It does increase the PIF because it is an added component of the calculation.
Okay.
So the Rome recommendation change is to modify the formula to accommodate the trail-related capital projects, and the park boundaries will remain the same, but we're going to revisit that later on. So the one thing, we weren't able to actually get park boundary consolidated in this time frame. It's just too tight. We've got so many meetings that we've got to get process that through. So that so we just narrowed our focus down the trails, so we got through this year. Up on the screen, you're going to see the fifth map. And you can see districts 1 through 4 are basically city of Vancouver. We share PIFs, districts 5. We have a line share of districts. We have all 6. A line share of 7. Line share of 8, we have all of 9, and 10. So basically, we have just districts 5 through 10. So the question is about 40, basically repeats verbatim what the RCW, RCW states, repeats verbatim. So we want to make sure that we include the public facilities, we include the open the trails as a component of the recreation in that definition. So the common industry interpretation would include trails as recreation facilities, so that's what we're striving for. So numerous municipalities across the state incorporate trails as a recreation facility in the finding and impact fees. If you look in the other handout, you actually see this this PIF memo. You actually see locally that we've got several jurisdictions around us that already include trails within their PIF program, so Canvas Center, Ridgefield, and then Olympia, Issaquah, Pierce County, and Thurston County. So the current county plans contain goals, policies, and supporting documentation regarding the plan or recommend capital improvements to enhance and expand the recreational trail system. So we can see that within our comprehensive plan. So this is our parks, recreation, open space plan, the trails and bikeway system plan, bicycle and pedestrian master plan, and the parks cap facility plan, which is actually inside. So that one handout I gave you is actually attachment of the post plan. So it's a holdout. It shows all the projects that we have slated for the next 6 years, as well as the long range plan for 20 years. Okay. So what we propose to include on the screen here is text edit, is the impact fee component for parks, open space, and recreation facilities is current language, and the underlined red is which include the acquisition or development of public open spaces devoted to public parks, playgrounds, and trails and other recreational purposes. And it goes back to the regular language here. And then under, of course, under the modification of the formula, we're actually adding trail paths. landscape. So the inclusion of the trail costs based on previously adopted parks, the capsules plan, and the population growth forecast, we see this chart here. If you look at the capsule plan, that's where that $10,598,000 comes from. It's a combination of the acquisition and development that we've got identified in the next 6 years. Although we have, today, we have really not done trails because we've not had a funding mechanism to engage that outside of trying to go after some grants. So without having park impact fees to support development acquisition, we really don't have a way to do that. We are now going after real estate excise tax funding to help assist us with that. So if we engage park impact fee dollars, we're also going to be using real estate excise tax or REIT 2 funding to match that component. So there's a public share component that goes along with the park impact fees. We want to make sure that's a little bit balanced. So on this next grid, you're actually going to see what we currently have for park impact fee rates. In the year one, this is 2017. This is year one of the park impact fee increase that we're experiencing that was actually implemented last year. And the yellow shaded area is this current year. So it was implemented in 17 at 80% of the full increase. This year's at the 90%. And in 19 will be the 100% full increase. So that was what was approved back in 16 to be implemented in 17. So I just basically explained that with this slide. So this next slide, it actually shows what the increase will be if we were to include trails. And so right now on the left-hand column that you see under 2018 is what our current rate is. If we do include the trails, it would go from 3,018 to 4,088 proposed. What we're actually proposing is not to increase the PIP, just leave it alone. We don't actually necessarily have to, although it has to be included in the calculation, doesn't mean we have to raise the 50. So what our recommendation is that to the council will be to leave the current cost alone, so not to increase. So just basically explain that. So to recommend the council at this time to implement text amendment 2040 to incorporate trails in the program and keep the current PIF rates as is on the previous approved schedule for phase implementation. So we, Lori and I have got several steps to go through before this gets approved. We definitely want to reach out to several different groups, the BIA. We want to have this discussion with them. We wanted to go to NAC and have that discussion. I have, this is new. This information has just came out to me from our consultant, and I haven't actually had a chance to even pass this by my parks advisory board yet. So we're kind of ahead of schedule here. So this is primarily going to be the same presentation, maybe a little bit different than what I would give you on October 4th if we were to have that meeting. So I don't know, that's a question that I have for you, is if you want me to come back and present again to you as a natural progression towards going to the Planning Commission and then ultimately to the board. So we can have that discussion here if this satisfies that discussion. The one document I still owe you is the actual PIP technical document, which is what Title 40 points to. This is a synopsis of that document, and so it basically has all the key components of what that document is going to have, but the document itself is a little bit more involved, if you will, so, which is what the PIP points to. So I will get that to you as soon as it's prepared, and as soon as we get that vetted for our Parks Advisory Board. And so that is essentially it. We're really never begun to get all of the vetting process done so we can get this approved by the end of the year. Any questions?
There are a few questions, comments, I guess. One, I love the idea of including trails in the parks plan. That was something that came out of our discussion previously. And I started writing this comment until I saw that you're leaving the PIFs alone, but I still think it's important to say is that I think, you know, including it in is kind of an you include the entire thing in. So one other component to this is, you know, if the trails are included in, then it needs to go towards meeting the county park goals. So when those are added in, other parks can come out because we don't need as much area. And then hopefully when you do that park, it has to be kind of a comprehensive look at it. So when those come out, less is needed, the PIF fee might not have to go up like you proposed. And we're also looking at other revisions to that plan through the subcommittee that was set up. So again, I think we have to look at it you know, holistically and included in all of that, not just the PIF calculation. And then again, because of that, I also support leaving the PIF alone until we go through the rest of the plan and figure out how to, I guess, kind of value engineer that plan and look at making sure it meets the needs. We're including all the park area, including all the trail areas now. And it might end up, and I think the idea is to try to get that PIF down to where it was a little more reasonable. Because it went up significantly on this last one, and I think that the councilors, when they approved it, had said, we're approving it, but we're committing to looking at it again to see if we can find some value in there and take another look at the plan. So as part of that process, I'd support this. And then my last comment would be, you had a date up there about like if you needed to come back to us. And maybe what we would do is revisit it prior to the December 8th hearing. Because it's bound to have some changes when it goes through Planning Commission, through your Parks Board. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to see that final version one more time, but I don't think we need to do that the other October one. I think it's too early. But so those are my comments.
That's good. And I do really appreciate the development of the subcommittee that we have working together. So, Steve, Eric, and Terry, the three of you, and we've got Barbara Anderson, who's on our subcommittee, and we have Councilman Jay, that will be there as well. I believe your first meeting is next week.
Sometime next week.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I really appreciate that again. So, once again, when we met last month and the month before, we actually talked about that subcommittee talking about just things like the credits, the addition of pocket parks, that kind of thing. And so that whole discussion is going into. And so with that, we'll probably be looking at the 2018 topic to include any changes that we discussed, that plus the consolidation of the districts. So that's kind of the goal. You know.
Do you need a motion from us today? Or something to bring to, I guess, Planning Commission and the other boards?
That need to be held off then?
Well,
they come back to us?
Well, we could talk about the version we saw, and it can be kind of general. I mean, I think as a board, I guess I would propose that we support the idea of including trails into the parks plan. So that's, I think, a simple statement. That's something that we came up.
I think we can make that into a motion very easily.
Okay, yes. And then I also think there's more to it, though, because when we're conveying that forward, I think that we also need to make sure that the other pieces that we just talked about also get in there, where we need to look at this holistically and make sure that when the parks are added, other components come out to meet that goal. And we also support not raising the PIF fee until we look at the entire park plan. Does that make sense? Is that, it's kind of a convoluted motion. I'm trying to get the words right, but I think the first part of it is Deeb supports the idea of including trails into the parks plan. We also support leaving the PIF alone until we can look at the impact to the parks plan holistically.
Making the motion, but
yeah, no, but it's
open.
You cut it right there.
Yeah.
Does that work?
That's good.
Okay. Trying to keep it simple.
Second.
All second.
All right.
All right.
We have a motion and a second to support the inclusion of trails and to support not increasing the PIF fees until we can look at the whole thing a little more holistically. All right. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? There you go.
Could I ask you a question before you split? The information kind of is like drinking from a fire hose a little bit, but impact fees and REIT dollars, are they divided between, for instance, acquisition and development? Are they all blended together and used? How does that happen?
Impact fees, back in 2014, park impact fees were combined, acquisition development were combined.
Okay.
Which I thought was wonderful because prior to that, acquisition got the lion's share of the funding for development was always starting. And so with this, we have to have a public share component that goes with it, and that can be anything but that. So real estate excise taxes, grants, donations, any of that kind of stuff can act as a match.
Okay.
So a lot of times when we acquire a piece of property, we only have this much money to spend, and then a lot of times the remaining amount we donated, and so we can actually, so they can write that off, and then that actually acts as some of our match.
And is maintenance then part of the development?
No.
That's still another?
This is a restricted fund. So okay. It's only for acquisition development.
It looks to me on here that the real estate excise tax is primarily used for development and not for acquisition.
So no, acquisition, no, we cannot be used for acquisition.
Okay.
So we have to use other forms of funding.
Yep.
Long, long time ago, I sat on the Parks Committee or whatever, and we recommended that a certain percentage of the REIT, we increased the REIT. Is there still a certain percentage of REIT that's going?
Yeah, I believe it's 25 cents per thousand for the REIT. So that's where it's at still today. There's a REIT 1 and a REIT 2. REIT 2 is what we primarily tap into.
Okay.
For parks. And historically speaking, we used to get 50% of the REIT that was
part. Yeah, that's right. I know there was a big.
And, so back in the Great Recession, if you call it,
yeah.
That was all shifted over to. Debt service.
So that's remained shifted over at this point?
Yeah, so we're just now getting back to the point where we can actually start dedicating the REIT back to parks.
Okay.
Once parks, roads, and there's one other component up there. But primarily, we're hoping that we can get at least 50% of it back to the parks.
That'd be nice, huh? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Jose Alvarez, and I'm with Community Planning, and I'm project manager on the implementation of the freight rail dependent use project. So in October of last year, the legislature amended the Growth Management Act to allow two counties, Clark and Okanagan counties, to adopt development regulations on resource lands adjacent to short line railroads for freight rail dependent uses. It was Representative Pike and Senator Wilson that were really instrumental in getting this bill passed, and the idea was really to try to encourage economic development along the county's short line railroads. By trying to take advantage of additional land along the red line. In November of last year, the county wanted to begin implementation of this bill, and we came up with a two-phase implementation approach. The first was to amend the comprehensive plan policies. Since the legislature had to amend the Growth Management Act, we didn't have the ability to allow for this to happen without amending our comprehensive plan. So we did that, and we created an overlay map, which I'll show you in a second. The three elements that we amended in the plan were the land use chapter, transportation chapter, and the rural resource chapter. So the area highlighted in red, or outlined in red, it was the existing, this is what we adopted in January of this year, where freight rail dependent uses would be allowed, and then we would come back and create development regulations for those things. The area in orange is ag zone property, and then the area in blue are parts of the rural industrial land bank that were under appeal. This gray area is the urban growth boundary, the gray outline, so that's already urbanized. So the second phase of the implementation was council identified a an advisory committee, which was essentially a subcommittee of the Railroad Advisory Board with three additional members from the Parks Advisory Board, the Farm Bureau, and a representative from the Greater Brush Prairie Neighborhood Association. We had 6 meetings between March and June 20th of this year to essentially come up with development standards, the use list, and their recommendations that I'll go over in a moment. So the freight rail dependent uses, the bill defined that as buildings and other infrastructure used in the fabrication, processing, storage, and transport of goods where the use is dependent on, makes use of, and adjacent to the shoreline railroad. So we spent quite a bit of time on the first 2 meetings trying to define some of these terms. I kind of went back and forth on that, and I'll show you what depended on, and adjacent was a really big issue. So the advisory committee recommendations are in your packet there. One of the first things we talked about the definition of adjacent. In our code, we have adjacent defined as near or close, and we distinguish that from abutting, which is testing. And so the advisory committee recommended that we define adjacent as 1 mile from the rail line. So that's the area in green is parcels within a mile of the railroad between the Vancouver UGA, which is outlined in pink to the south, and the Battleground UGA to the north. The committee had made this recommendation in their second to last meeting. There was a subsequent work session with council, and after that they decided to scale this back, and the hash mark area is what their proposal became. They didn't have time to amend the definition, so they kept that still 1 mile. So when we went out to the public, we, without the change to the definition, potentially those areas could still be eligible for freight rail dependent uses in the future, so we wanted to let public know about that. And the area in red is the sort of the existing area. Just for some context, the area outlined in red is about 300 acres. The hash mark area is about 2,100, and the area in green is 6,100 acres. So the rest of the recommendation is really the code, or the new code section that has freight rail dependent uses. We really kind of started with sort of the industrial code section. The committee narrowed that down using those definitions of dependent on and makes use of the rail lines to try to locate uses that within that NAICS code that would fit those uses that could be considered freight rail dependent. So that's what's in your handout. There's also the use list, the building development standards. I think there's 100-foot building height is what the advisory committee recommended. If it's abutting or adjacent to residential property, it's maybe 60 feet. With the use list, we try to follow the light industrial, although they did add asphalt batch plants and chemical manufacturing, which currently are allowed in the heavy industrial, but as conditional uses.
Great. Jose?
Yes.
Asphalt and concrete. What'd you say? Asphalt and?
Asphalt batch plants. And chemical manufacturing.
And chemical manufacturing. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I thought you mentioned concrete. I think concrete is permitted. And it doesn't matter. Conditional use for the asphalt, sorry.
Right. So the other sections that we amended, the land use, the landscaping standards, and a lot of it was just cross-referencing transportation standards, was to get the industrial road standards. If you're going to have this, made sense to use the industrial road standards. There's a plan amendments section that for any future expansion, the process would be sort of a minimum of 100 acres and going through the Type 4 process. There's also an option if property owners want to opt out of the overlay, which we've never done, so this would be interesting how that gets administered. And then the other element was they proposed extending sewer outside of the urban growth boundary, which currently isn't allowed, with minor exceptions for health hazards or to service or the school. So sort of a timeline.
Can you repeat what you said about the sewer extension?
Currently, sewer is not allowed to be extended outside of your road boundary, with few exceptions, one being health hazards, and the other being to serve a public school.
And in this, what's the recommendation for?
They are recommending that sewer be allowed to be extended to serve these freight rail tenant uses.
Very good, thank you.
So we had an open house last Thursday at Hawkinson High School. We had about 170 folks attend. Had some concerns. And we have a survey online that we are, that's going to be open until the 13th. And we're going to collect all of that information, the surveys, the input from the public. And we're having a work session with council on the 26th of September to sort of see what direction they want to go, if they want to proceed with the recommendations as is, or make some modifications to that before we go to the Planning Commission. So we have, you know, we have to go to the Planning Commission and Council, but we haven't set our dates for that yet.
Go ahead.
Would, if sewer is not available out there, would septic still be a viable option for development of the presence of properties?
I think it depends on the use.
Okay.
I know that
yeah. You'd have to go through, you know, everything with what kind of college health.
And probably ecology.
Ecology.
Yeah.
Okay.
And like what the casino.
But it doesn't include the ability to do that, or at least look into the viability. Thank you.
Or porta potties. No, in all seriousness, no. For mining uses like concrete batch plants and things like that.
Clark County Public Health.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Could you indicate what the concerns were, or the most serious concerns that were voiced at this public hearing? Assuming you were there.
Oh, I was there.
All right. They were addressed to you?
I can imagine.
Let's see, it sort of ranged the gamut from the their property being affected and essentially becoming industrial land, property values, impacts to roads if you are going to have this sort of large an area with essentially industrial uses. How's that going to affect the roads that aren't that great, primarily rural roads now? There were, I think that's pretty established already. How's this adjacent mile? But a lot of concerns about the potential impacts to their property and
sure.
how this could change.
Is there a buffer? Does this change in the law provide any kind of buffer between a residential property and where?
So what the law does is put it on the county to develop those regulations, and the advisory committee had some recommendations for landscaping. Right. And so I think there was a minimum of an L3 standard, but it would be up to the responsible official to go to an L5 standard, depending on, I think, the building height. If it's adjacent to residential property, it drops down from 100 to 60 feet. So those are some of the things that were the advisory committee recommended. And those are things that the planning commission and council will review.
Thank you.
There's one item in here that talks about the screening of the facility or the property. In addition to, it would appear to me, in addition to the L5 or L3 standard, there's an additional requirement for a row of evergreen trees, 10 feet on center, 4 feet when they're planted, with some other standards with regards to the tree size and type and variety and stuff. So it sounds to me like it's taking it from a protecting offsite property standpoint, it goes over and above what the minimum landscape standards are for other properties.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And so these are some of the ways to participate or give us feedback. They're pretty detailed website with a lot of information on the proposal, linked to all of the committee meetings that were recorded, all the minutes from all of those meetings.
Yeah, one last quick question for me, at least if you had one. There's a section in here that talked about before the county considers establishing a new freight rail dependent use overlay area, the proponent shall submit to the county a petition signed by at least 60% of the property owners of the land within the boundaries of the proposed new overlay, which shall be no less than 100 acres. That seems cumbersome, but maybe it's not. Is there some precedence for that? Is that similar to like an annexation?
It's similar to what we've done in establishing rural centers.
Like a new rural site.
Yes.
Okay. So although it's not everyone in that whole area, it's just the new area that's going to be brought in. So 60%. If you're taking a new area.
So think of, we were looking at this area between Vancouver UGA and about Bellingham UGA. Mm-hmm. Depending what we end up with, that'll be that area. That was really intended to say if you go outside of north of Battleground, we get investment, and so right. We invest in the rail. That area hasn't been looked at. That would be the process you would do to do that there.
Okay, that seems reasonable. I was just kind of curious where that came from.
So dovetailing on that, I have two questions, I guess. So you're saying to Eric's question, the area that's currently in blue, I guess, on that comprehensive plan map, mm-hmm. is that right? That doesn't require, if we bring it in under an overlay or whatever, that's not going to require the 60%. It's areas north. Because I was getting, and so my second question was there discussion of aggregate mining and Chalachi Prairie and areas like that? And
so Chalachi Prairie is already zoned heavy industrial.
Right.
If they want to use that, and the rail can handle it.
Yeah, I was curious whether.
I think.
But was rock in general talked? Because I mean, I know it's been a while since I've been in the industry, but rail and water are the only, you know, other than a lot of truck traffic.
Those right. Are, I think the at one point the railroad operator had someone had expressed interest in that, and but the sense that I got is they wanted to maybe ship rock down to process it, and that's why the asphalt plant they were thinking about using it.
Oh, you never like
mining in Chalachi Prairie, but shipping by rail, processing it, and so they wanted to have that use be allowed, and so that's why the committee recommended that.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right.
Thank you.
So before we leave that alone, I assume that since you don't have your hearing scheduled for BC or the board yet, are you going to be coming back to us with any changes? Are you looking for a recommendation from us? At this point or later or?
If you want me to come back, I can do that when we get something a little more fleshed out. And
would that be appropriate? Well, yeah, I would like you to currently reserve your recommendations until we have a work session with the council, see if they narrow this down or give us more direction on how to proceed. Then we can come back, share that with you. Hey, we're ready to go to the planning commission. Here's how the council wants us to proceed. If you can wait with the hearing at that point, that would be more helpful.
Okay, sounds good.
Got it. Thanks.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Jan Bazala. I'm in community development, and I have been running the county's annual program process for a few years now. For those of you who may not be familiar with what biannual program is, it's an opportunity to amend the code to correct scrivener's errors, make reference updates, clarify standards, and also make some minor policy changes. So we used to do that every twice a year with all the development review that's been going on for a month to complete that. We did a batch last year, and we have a relatively small batch this year. We've got about 9 items currently on the list. We have not yet been to the board. We're going to go to the board at a work session in October 3rd and propose this list to them and see if they want to go ahead with those items. Assuming they do, the planning commission is scheduled for a work session on these on November 1st, and the hearing would be on November 11th. So wanted to get these to you a little bit early. So you'll have a chance to look at these today. There'll also be time for you to look at them at the next meeting in October as well. So starting out, item number one would be to add the rural accessory dwelling units, just include them into the resource use tables. Last year, ADUs were allowed in the resource zones and in the rural zones. The listing, it's a line item in the use tables, was not done. So we'll be doing that. It's not a change of anything, it's just an additional reference where they should be listed. Number two is an amendment to the development review fee table. It's a proposal to add an intake fee for type 1 applications. Currently, type 2 and 3 applications have an intake fee, and an intake fee covers the cost of staff fully complete review, which is when you review the application, make sure certain minimum standards of the application are met, and also that review helps determine the final specific civil fees for the application. Type 1 applications do not have an intake fee at this point. We do spend quite a bit of time getting Type 1 applications into an approval format. Also, the county is going to be implementing a new permit tracking system, and that is going to require an intake fee. That was done to, if they did require an intake fee, it would have required applicants to submit private more information electronically in order to determine whether an application really was type 1 or type 2. So it was determined that the easier way to do that would be just to have an intake fee, and then staff would review the applications just as we are now, and winnow out what needs to be included in the application and make sure it is a type 1 worthy application. I don't know that that fee has been finally established. I think the idea is about $250, my understanding. So that's that. Any questions on that? Okay. Item number three is an amendment to the fire fee table. Fire marshal requested an amendment to the fire fee table. Apparently, when an application or when somebody fails fire inspection, they get one free re-inspection fee. But sometimes some applicants just don't want to comply or have difficulty doing so, and the fire marshal is going out there multiple times, and there's no fee that the table allows for. So this would give the fire marshal the ability to charge fees for additional re-inspections. Number four and number five are amendments to the Land Division approval criteria for tracks. Currently, there are approval criteria for tracks in the short plat section, and number four shows the language in that. So number four starts on page one, moves over onto page two. We're going to clean up that language a little bit. Basically, it says that if you have a tract that's established in platting, you can't build on it unless it gets reviewed unless you would actually go through the platting process, because tracts are not intended for residential building lots. Apparently, there was a boundary line adjustment that was challenged, and it went to a hearing, and there was a situation where a non-buildable subdivision tract ultimately got appealed and ultimately got approved for building, because there was, one of the reasons, there was no such language in the subdivision code about non-buildable tracts. And so this language that we're also adding into subdivision code is intended to close that loophole and make sure that that does not occur again.
Jan, how's a non-buildable track defined? Does it mean it has wetlands, or it's the stormwater?
Yeah, they can be those. It can be a stormwater track, it can be a wetland track.
I missed that. A park?
The steel hazard.
Oh, you're right. Okay. Okay.
Common open space.
Sure. Okay.
So, I mean, generally speaking, this is no different than what, this is not a new thing, but
right.
Clarification.
Okay. Thank you.
Number six. That was a revision to revise some figures in the geohazard code. Upon further review, we realized that there may be some other cleanups that need to be done to the geohazard code, and to fix the figures at this point would be perhaps not the best. There's still questions. When you start looking at the figure, there are still some questions that I think they need to be revised and looked at as a whole under the geohazard code. So Allie and I talked about this morning. It doesn't appear that this is a critical issue that comes up every day. And so we think that we should just delay this item. So currently kind of not proceed with item number six.
Okay.
So number seven is on, starting on page five. It is a proposal to eliminate bonds for temporary uses. So I bet a number of people are going to be happy about this. So this temporary use code requires that the applicant post the bond for $500 and then they submit for a temporary use. Then we hold it, and then in the event that the temporary use does not go away within 30 days, then the county, in theory, has this money to make sure that the use goes away. It's proven to be a very cumbersome process. We don't see them very often. And so we're proposing just to eliminate that bonding requirement and just defer that if the application or if an applicant does not get rid of the temporary use in timely fashion, we'll just institute the normal code enforcement process.
$2,500, unless you raise it, doesn't get you very far for the process, is what you're saying, probably.
Maybe. That is also true. It's hardly worth the administrative burden of going through that exercise.
Yeah. And I've done two of those, and I thought there was no need.
Yeah, I just see it. Yeah.
Simplifying. In my experience, the temporary use is as a result of, and I'm sure that there could be other reasons, but it's as a result of needing to do something temporarily while something else is being done. In one instance, it was we had to move an office to a residence temporarily while the other offices in the other building were being remodeled.
I think a big one is construction of highways and things like that. Does that come under temporary, where people need mobile things?
Some of them are exempt. I mean, well,
I'm thinking about sorts like quarries and things like, again, I'm going back to rock, but I remember we used to get temporary uses for buildings and things like that, or asphalt plants, mm-hmm. Concrete plants, things that will provide for a specific job that may be a different code
crushing,
section.
Sometimes crushing off-site, something like that.
Yeah.
Good.
But it's...
Yeah. All right. So the next, number 8, is various amendments to transportation code, 350030. Numerous items, my understanding is that the DOT has seen most of these before. Since I am not a transportation person, I am going to turn the floor over to, I think, Dallas or somebody from transportation, and they can discuss these various amendments.
Basically, the first thing is site distance, and the change in site distance is previously there was something about the height, that height was 3.5 at the object height and 4.25 beneath us. 3.5 as the driver height and 4.25 as the object height. In 2011, after changed that to 3.5 to 3.5, and that had never been updated in our code, so that is now consistent with the actual and washed out codes. So that is the first change. And the second change is stopping site distance. Similar to that, the previous there were differences between what the actual code was for actual and washed out code was for stopping site distance and what the county code was. So the revised code brings the county code in line with the ASHTO and WASHTOR codes. And so, and there is a minor change here in controls intersection side distance. Is it talks about the distance from where you measure the side distance. Originally, it was called vehicle travel lane. It's now defined as vehicle travel way, which is basically where the fog line is, or which means the vehicle was where the vehicle can normally travel.
So between the lines?
Yes, so between the lines, or if there is...
Is that what we're trying to...
If there is a frontage that's 500 feet long, but you know you're coming in left lanes, it's going that way, so, or there is a parking. Our parking lane is not defined by a stripe, so then it would be that's where the vehicle would travel. It would not travel next to having the curb.
Right.
So in that case, or and I think in Washington, in some cases that would be the case, but in case where the vehicles are not parked, then you would take the base of the curb as the edge of the travel.
Trying to figure out that. I think I understand that. I'm trying to figure out the practical effects. I'm not an engineer. I don't know, Eric, if you can.
I don't think it's, yeah.
Any big practical effects? Yeah. I mean, it seems like it might work out.
And just for layman's term, 28 feet is the normal edge to edge, face to curve to face of curve.
Yeah.
And then you would take from the face of curve, go back 15 feet, and that would be the position of the driver's tire.
Gotcha. Okay.
And the other thing is the distance from the clear distance, so there can be nothing that's below 8.5 feet high. Previously it was about 7 feet, and now that distance is 8.5 feet. That is in line with our landscaping code. So there can be no trees, branches, fences, or anything that's lower than 8.5 feet.
So how does one then figure for like new street trees and stuff that they might only be 8 or 10 or 12 feet tall once they're installed? They might have branching patterns that are lower.
Yes, and that has been an issue with some of them. As in fact, I'm looking at one in fact now at Fredmar, where they have it's young tree, and their branches are lower, and we tend to go and cut those off if it starts to create a sinus problem. Because if you are in a vehicle, you're fine, but if you're in a pickup truck or a higher truck,
right,
and if the branches are less are lower than that, you won't get the sinus.
Well, street trees aren't allowed in some districts. So I guess that's the issue.
Is this consistent with like ASHTO or some other guidance than the 8 feet? Is that the James elsewhere, or is it just the counties?
What ASHTO told, there can be nothing in the line of sight.
Okay.
It should be
clear. So the 3 and 7 was something that the county did?
For landscaping purposes.
For landscaping.
And the other change is yield control intersection. And this is something that is now in ASHTO part. It came in 2011, ASHTO. Before that, there was no guidance regarding yield sign distance. So further, we have updated our code for yield for ASHTO. This is for residential area. If it's 25 miles an hour, then a side distance triangle 130 feet back to 250 feet. And there are various other codes for other speeds, but mainly if we have a yield control, that would mainly be in residential area. So we have only address.
Often does this come up? I would think like almost never.
Is this a new heading, new urban and rural residential driveways? Is that just a heading change? There's no substance change for that? Number 8, page 9, line 4.
New and urban residential driveways access and speed limit.
Is that just because the number changed? Is that it?
Yeah, I think so. That is obviously that code.
Okay. Yeah.
So the next change is the barricade. So previously we used to state that if there is an end of the road, then we just put a 5-3 barricade. And we used to do that, but what we found out that type 3 barricades are costly to install and harder to maintain. So what we have done is that in some cases where it's appropriate and it's not a hazard, then instead of a factory barricade, we could put end of road marker. That's easier to install and cheaper to install and easier to maintain. And that depends on the situation. If there's no drop off, there's no ditch, if it's no, you know, so we can 5 mile an hour road, then there is this option that instead of barricade, you install end of road marker. Change the previous code only mentioned MUTCD as one of the guidelines we follow, but Washington State has a slightly modified MUTCD like every other state, so there might be some changes to the natural FHW MUTCD, and that's that we have clarified that we will be following the Washington State process. The next one is passing side distance. Prior to 2011, there was discrepancy between the passing side distance specified in ASHTO and passing side distance, which was also adopted by WatchDOT, and passing side distance that was introduced in 2011. ASHTO recommended that they would be adopting the MUTCD side distance, and that's the change.
Does this affect how then lane striping, or where the lane striping takes place?
Yes.
Which side gets the solid arrows?
Yeah. For example, you know, previously for 50 miles an hour, the side distance was 1,800 feet. For the new code, it's 800 feet. So there is this change. However, there is also something we have in the traffic manual. That's per, you know, NCHRB 605 from where this was taken. So what that does is you can't have a passing side distance of, let's say, 50 feet. Back is over 50 feet. So it has to be something like a minimum distance. Even if you do have, you have to have a minimum distance of passing zone. And so by the same token, you have to have a minimum distance of no pass zone. So there are, those details are mentioned in our traffic manual for Clark County. And there are other things, you know, where you can pass and cannot pass. Prior to railroad crossing, for example, you can just end your passing at the railroad crossing at a certain distance. Okay. So those details are specified in our traffic manual. And what it also mentions here clarifies that from now on it would be for the latest edition of access. So let's say 2 years from now or 3 years from now. If these changes, then you would be following whatever the ASHTO and WatchDOT adopted.
And you wouldn't have to change.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to change.
Could I ask you a question? It just will show my ignorance because I'm not an engineer, but in the passing site distance table, it seems like everything up to this point, it appears that the changes being made are to increase safety.
Yes. Some of it is increased safety. What they found was that the prior 1,100 feet for 30 miles, so it was too excessive, and there were too little side distance and passing zones, and people were generally not in compliance. So, you know, because there was so little passing zone, people were passing in the no passing.
Okay.
And in the field, we've been practicing for years. We've been practicing these new numbers, these new distances. Our code just hasn't caught up to what we've been doing. So that is, did the code caught up to what we've been doing in the field?
And nationally, most agencies have been following MUTCD, which is now also actual. So what ASHTO figured out is nobody's following their code and everybody's following MUTCD. So they bought it in line with MUTCD.
So really what it comes down to is it's a way to take care of non-compliance with people passing and not passing them, because there is not enough area to create a passing zone.
Yes. The other change is H, that is the school zone traffic control. So there is a section in MUBCD that does talk about school zone traffic control. And we have also what we call RCW, Revised Code of Washington, and Washington Administrative Code. And those were not very, first of all, the MUBCD was very general. And back and RCW, MUBCD didn't exactly agree with each other. So what we did is we took all those, we took the best practices, and we created a document called School Zone Traffic Control, that's for Clark County. That is based on MUBCD. And what this is saying is, if there is a school, and that relates to mostly crosswalks and school zone flashers and things like that, and school zone traffic control. So what it's saying, if there is a new school that comes in, or there is a change to an existing school, and that in any way, shape, or form affects the crosswalk or any school zone traffic control, then they will have to report up to the Clark County document, which is school zone traffic control. And similar to that, we also have a document that's called pedestrian crossing treatment. And Ashko does talk about, you know, what a crosswalk is and what the signing and striping is. We had been getting requests for crosswalks, for example. We have been getting requests for median island or hockey, but there was no guidance in when do you install the oxygen, when do you install the median line, when do you install the crosswalk. So based on national practice and research, we created a document that talks about what are the set of circumstances when you do certain treatments. And so what this is saying is that when developments come in, or when we do a capital project, or the request that comes in, we will be following that document, which is called pedestrian traffic control. Just to make it consistent all across the board, we need to do a similar kind of treatment for similar set of circumstances. The rest of them, I think, it talks about reimbursable work order for, you know, the timing striking. That's the standard that we're doing. And it talks about private to private route signs. That's the responsibility of the developer. We have been practicing for decades. Street name sign is for public private route. That's the responsibility of the county, and we have been practicing it for a very long time. We go to page number 8, temporary barricades. Here also it says current adopted version of MUBCD, because sometimes they change and our code doesn't change. So if there is a change in MUBCD, then we go to the current adopted version by the state of Washington. I find it may be used when traffic is maintained to. This is just a semantics paragraph 2, which says type planning to barricades may be used when traffic is maintained to. Before it says area being constructed instead, and that's been upgraded to a language that calls temporary traffic control. It's the same thing, isn't it? Just a different change in language. And then number should be used closely. Okay. Number 3 is, in general, type 3 permanent barricade should be installed close to installed to close arterials and through streets to traffic. So it means there was a term hazardous. So if there is an arterial that's been closed, then a type 3 directory should be used. That's all it's saying as a treatment. This is again as against local access street, which is 25 miles an hour, where you may use end of road marker. Type 3 barricades or end of road marker object and should be used at the end of a local access street, temporarily terminating abruptly without cul-de-sac. So again, this is the same thing we are talking about, is if there is a local access street, you don't have to use a type 3 barricade. There's this option and choice of using end of road markers subject to the preconditions. And also in the same paragraph, sometimes it becomes necessary that, or it's an option, that in a type 3 barricade, we may also require installation of end of road object marker for increased safety. I think this was probably the previous version too, which is talking about dead end streets. Maybe extending future should have a type 3 barricade and a side place, giving notice that the road will be extended in future and an information and telephone number. And this is because we had calls previously where citizens have called and said the realtor told them this type of road is never going to go. So, because of that, we face a barricade which says, you know, road will be extended in future, just to let people know that at some point in time it's going to be extended. I think that's all. From the today.
So, I have a question on this last one. So, the shoulds on this page 15 about barricades, is that what you guys are going to want to stay with, should or shall?
I would think we should make it shall. It's an option. Either you put a barricade or end up from marker. So it's an alternate.
What am I?
That's
yeah.
What that's what we caught. You just recently read.
Oh, okay.
So,
gotcha.
So yeah.
Okay. So let's set up the term shaft. The should. The way it works is may is an option. Should is strongly recommended. Shall is you have to do so. It should have been written shall. Maybe you either put a barricade or you put an end of the marker.
So that probably will show up on line 13, 17. 18 and 27 for my review here. So we'll change that in the next subsequent versions. All right. Guys, any questions on any of those? No? Okay. All right. So then. We'll move on to what turns out to be the second number 8. That's a typo. It should be number 9. It's on bottom of page 15. It's to update the wetland code and enable reduced wetland buffers in areas of low habitat function. And since this is an area of which I know nothing, I'm going to let Brent talk.
That's a good idea.
All right, so this is part of what I briefed you on last meeting. We're on page 16. That's really the substance of this proposed change with the buffer width that the new ecology guidance recommends. As I mentioned last time, the big change is categorizing wetlands that score 5 points on the habitat portion of the wetland rating form as low habitat function, as opposed to currently they're defined as moderate. That's when the buffers, moderate is when the buffers start to get larger to protect the habitat functions in the wetland. It's also a threshold that we've used to determine how much flexibility you have to put stormwater facilities in the buffers without having to do additional mitigation. So that's a pretty significant benefit. Unfortunately, it's not all good news. The ecology guidelines, so our code currently took an incremental approach by each individual point having the buffer increase incrementally. And ecology's new guidelines for that incremental approach is heavily weighted to larger buffers the further you go up the scale. And so applying that would actually, number one, for 5 points, we get a little bit of a benefit, but not as much as what this proposal has. And then at 6, 7, and 8, and 9 points, well, like 9 is the maximum, but 6, 7, and 8 points, the buffers would actually get bigger. And mathematically, the way that it's structured, there's no way of finding a middle ground that we could justify without having to do a bunch of the best available science work. So this approach is to lump it into 3 buckets, which is low, moderate, and high function. So 3, 4, and 5 points is low, 6 and 7 points is moderate, 8 and 9 points is high. And the biggest impact that has, other than the reduction for the 5 points, is that particularly for category 3 wetlands, buffers are going to get bigger if you score 6 points. One of the questions last time had to do with how does this actually translate to the real world? I had a recommendation to look at some specific examples, and I thought, for thinking about it, it might be better to actually give you an idea of how this would look over all the wetlands that we have actually rated since 2015 when this new rating system went into effect. So I pulled the data, we keep all that in our GIS, for about 230 wetlands that we've rated over that time.
Can you look at the last page?
If you look at the last page, there's a couple of graphs, bar charts. The first chart is the actual magnitude of the proposed changes by the habitat score on the rating form. And so the vertical scale is a plus or minus in feet. So you can see that for score 5 points on the habitat portion of the rating form, and this is for the high intensity buffers, which are the ones you're generally dealing with urban development, you're going to see a reduction in 40 feet of buffer from what's currently required. On the flip side, for a habitat score of 6 points, for category 3 wetlands, you're going to see an increase of 15 feet. So the current buffer is 135. The proposal, based on ecology guidelines, is 150 feet. The other decreases and increases for scores of 7, 8, and 9 points can be substantial, but they're relatively infrequent. What the second graph shows you is if you take the actual magnitude and multiply it by the rate of occurrence in the sampling of 200 and some wetlands that we rated in the last few years, you can see the relative magnitude and percent change on average for these different circumstances. So you can see that the magnitude of the change for the reduction for a score of 5 points is a little bit more than twice the downside for the score of 6 points for category 3 wetlands. I was actually surprised when I looked at the statistics. The score of 6 points for the rating of category 3 is actually the most common occurrence that we've had. 24% of the wetlands we rated actually scored that way. Fairly evenly balanced between the urban and rural area, slightly more in the rural area. The habitat score of 5 points was at 18%. So if you average it all out, it's estimated overall net reduction of about just under 4% of total buffer width is what this change would result in. But there will be cases where buffers will be a little bit bigger. So that's it in a nutshell.
So you're kind of saying, though, that the buffers are going to be bigger in the fives. Is it the fives or the sixes? The sixes. And that encompasses about 25% so far of the 250 wetlands.
Yeah, it's a change from 135 feet to 150 feet. So
right.
15-foot increase.
That's it.
Whereas the category five, or the score five, is a 40-foot decrease, plus the additional flexibility for stormwater facilities, which is something we've been struggling with in these bigger buffers. We're still going to struggle with it. When we have six or more points.
Putting stormwater facilities in the
without having to do additional mitigations.
Yeah.
I guess one other thing I will add is we're proposing to do this now because these guidelines came out recently. Whether we move forward with this at this time, we will be having to deal with this when we do our GAO update. In the future, we're not required to do that update until 2024, but community planning would like to have that update done in advance of the comp plan update is due at the same time. So we're likely to start looking at a CAO update sometime in 2020, 2021. So we're going to end up having this discussion eventually, regardless of whether it moves forward right now.
Why is the, what's the struggle with stormwater facilities within the buffer area?
Well, the code currently doesn't outright allow stormwater facilities and buffers in moderate and high habitat function buffers. We've allowed it in cases where the design of the facility allows us to conclude that there's going to be no net reduction in habitat function. We've had some cases where we've had to require some mitigation to get to that finding. The presumption is if you've got low habitat function, that putting the facilities in the buffer, potentially degrading habitat in that buffer, isn't going to have as much impact on the wetland because it's already functioning as a wetland.
Is that predicated based off of guidelines from farm ecology, or is that kind of wrong?
Yes, and I mean, there's a whole other discussion probably headed our way when the next stormwater manual update regarding these facilities in buffers, because there was explicit language in the previous stormwater manual about not putting stormwater facilities in buffers. And as far as I've been able to tell in the updated draft from ecology, they've removed that and put everything in the minimum requirement aid, which only really focuses on higher quality wetlands.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, okay. There's other.
That's what, it sounded good, but you never know with DOE. You just got to ask.
Based on the wetland guidance, there's still a concern about putting those facilities in areas with high habitat function or potential for high habitat function where they can degrade that function. So, regardless of where we end up with the stormwater manual, there's still a best available science discussion that we're going to have at some point about how much we can allow habitat function to be degraded in the buffers to accommodate stormwater.
Over time, though, if you vegetate, if you do the mitigation and vegetate a stormwater, aren't you providing at least a function of
equal or higher quality?
Yeah, that's
they
exactly.
They allow them in the buffer.
Well,
I know they do, but they.
Some recent projects.
Okay, good.
It's a big deal. I know you know that. It's a huge deal.
Part of it is if it's all fully forested, then maybe not, because it could take decades for that forestry to
reduce. I understand that.
And it also could depend on the type of facility. If it's a highly engineered system, it requires a lot of invasive maintenance, that's different than a more hazardous system.
Because the stormwater systems, you know, obviously are substantially larger.
Retire.
We're talking about a buffer area, not an actual wetland area. And I know this isn't necessarily what we're covering right now. It just seems to me that taking advantage of that buffer area and putting a system in that isn't, you're not really talking about use, but just water retention, filtration. I don't know, it just seems to be a really good, efficient use for the design, you know, so.
Right, and I don't disagree. I mean, like I said, we've been able to get there on a lot of projects recently where we've had a task force of 6 or 7 points because the buffer's already in a somewhat degraded state. There's places where we can squeeze it in and do grading without a whole lot of
property usually.
We make finding that once it's installed and operating and vegetated, that it's actually going to potentially enhance the habitat. And we have some successful examples.
Thank you, Brad.
Just one other note. It's likely that there'll also be some amendments to the nuisance code 9.24. I don't have those yet. They're not really development regulations per se, so I'm not expecting a lot of concern about it. So assuming that things stay roughly, well, pretty much the way they are in this version here, would you guys want to see these again next month? Or are you okay with things as they stand now?
I think most what we've done in the past, Jan, is that give 15 minutes, come in, highlight what's changed. Kind of that's it, then we can provide you our formal recommendation. Does that make sense?
Yep. It does. Question for Brett, though. Were you asking us, or were we basically saying, let's move this forward now and just bite the bullet and move it forward, is what you're asking, right?
It's in the package, and so, you know, if you want to make a recommendation to Jan.
That would be, I guess that would be the other thing I heard, is that, you know, we can bite the bullet and put the, it's not even biting the bullet, it's a question of, you know, but I think you were asking, seemed like you were asking us,
I was just
whether we want to move that your part forward or is that your part.
I'm
but
just letting you know that if it doesn't move forward now,
it will later.
We're going to deal with it later.
Yeah.
Right. And these all still do have to go through the board of work sessions, and Brent will be there to explain that again.
Yeah.
And they may provide direction on, you know, one way or the other.
Let's wait.
Yeah, there's nothing significant.
No.
None of the stuff that was proposed really, I don't know, it seems
I
pretty minimal.
I'll wait to see if there are any changes. So,
obviously,
all right.
Very
good.
Thank you, guys.
We're running a little late. Any public comment?
You want me to talk? I'm not going to the IP night, so. Any of you guys? Who's going for VIP night?